You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we hear about Senator Ron Johnson's Right to Try bill, which would give terminally ill patients more access to experimental drugs that haven't gotten FDA approval.
First, from the arrival of early European settlers to the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, conflicts over Native American lands have been a big part of American history. Last month, we talked to Naomi Schaefer Riley, author of the book The New Trail of Tears. She argued that reservations see high rates of poverty and suicide because of current federal policy on land ownership. The main problem with that policy, she argued, was that it didn't allow for private land ownership.
We heard from callers and listeners after that in Wisconsin, including some of the state's own Native American communities, who felt that the conversation needed another perspective. Our next guest recently wrote a piece for The Atlantic called Private Land Ownership Won't Solve Native American Poverty. That article's posted on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Kelly Mosteller. She's director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center and a tribal historic preservation officer based in Oklahoma. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And you say there's kind of a fundamental difference in some ways between the ways a lot of American culture thinks of land and the way Native American communities often do. You say in your article that for most Americans, land is money. How does that run counter to how a lot of tribal cultures view land?
Well, I think that the argument there is that it's not a simple link between land ownership equaling success and money. And I'm also not trying to argue that for Native Americans that we don't understand the importance of land for financial and economic gain. But in our case, we do have historic either ancestral ties to this land, or it is the source of our land base that allows us to have sovereignty and authority and dictate how our communities are managed and run. So, you know, for Native Americans, the land is not just, you know, that piece of property which we can buy and sell and exploit for financial gain. It has that cultural element, and it is the literal foundation of our tribal sovereignty and of our nations.
I want to listen to a little bit of our previous guest, Naomi Schaefer Riley, talking some about federal land policies and reservations.
Okay. Now, actually, the policies are preventing Native Americans from exercising economic freedom. And what I mean by that is that Native Americans don't actually own reservation land. The fact that it's held in trust by the federal government means that they can't buy it and sell it among themselves without the approval of staff member at the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington. It means that if an American Indian wanted to go to the bank and get a mortgage to purchase a house, he could not do that because the bank would say you don't have the underlying title to the land.
So what's your reaction to that and the rest of her argument for that matter?
Well, that statement has a lot of issues packed into it, and I feel like she glosses over that. The first thing is that there are 560-plus tribes in the United States, and each of them has their own circumstances. I know that you did get around to that eventually in the previous interview, but even the statement that Native Americans don't own their land, there are a lot of different land statuses for Native Americans. Individual tribal members can own land both in trust and in fee, which is essentially own it privately with some restrictions, and then tribes can also own land in trust or in fee or fee land without restrictions on it, so essentially like any other group would own land. So that argument has not even been made within her Atlantic article or the interview that I heard with you. She's really talking about strictly reservation land, and that's very different for a tribe that lives on a reservation than tribes like my own and all of the tribes in Oklahoma. We do not have true reservations in Oklahoma, and we have 39 tribes here. What we have is jurisdiction. Tribal lands are held in trust in a checkerboard pattern often because we purchase back lands that have been moved out of tribal hands, and we're purchasing them back as a tribe, but we own it first in fee. And then we go through the process to put it into trust so that it becomes part of our jurisdiction and our base of our authority for our tribal government. So even the argument that all land is reservation land and that it has this one distinct status, that oversimplifies the issue. Also, the current policy, as she states, is that the federal government owns the land and has the title to the land and holds it in trust for the tribes. And I don't have the exact quote, but I do believe that she mentioned something that you only hold things in trust for children or for those who are mentally incapable of caring for it for themselves. The status of trust land for Native American tribes is a little bit different than that. It's actually the trust relationship between the tribes and the federal government also means that the tribes have the guarantee of that the federal government should uphold their federal trust responsibility. So it's a two-way street. You know, it does put some restrictions on what the tribe can do with the land as far as selling it and things like that, but it also means that the federal government has an obligation to uphold the laws and the treaties and all of the pieces of legislation that protect that land from being taxed by local municipalities or encroached upon by landowners or corporations. And it provides some of the protections that Native Americans have experienced with a tax on their lands for more than two centuries.
We're talking to Kelly Mosteller, director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center. She's based in Oklahoma, talking about Native Americans and property ownership in the United States. And Kelly, our guest Naomi Schaefer Riley had talked about difficult conditions facing some Native Americans in some communities, poverty, suicide rates, things like that. She tried to draw a direct line between the current state of property ownership and said, don't keep looking to history or historic injustice to explain these problems. You say we need to pay attention to the history of American treatment of Native Americans and land ownership in particular. Can you spell that out a little?
Absolutely. You can't look at a people whose legal rights and legal foundations are built on 200-plus years of failed policies and the legislation that results from them, and to disregard the decades and decades of work that tribes have put into pushing for the honoring of treaties and for distancing ourselves from any kind of incursions by the federal government or other than individuals that would bring back policies like allotment, which is essentially what Naomi Schaefer Riley is pushing for. It's just repackaged in a 21st century format for, you know, free market audience. What we're trying to say is that to say that you have to disregard the history and only look at the current policy is naive of the fact that these policies that are impacting us today are built on those foundations. It is built on 200 years of colonialism and people being moved off of their land for the sake of taking it into private hands and exploiting it for non-Native communities. It looks at our residential schools and children being taken away from their families and that impact that it has on them and the hurt and the pain and the historic trauma that has been passed down through communities that does have a direct impact on the very statistics that she was mentioning, the suicide rates, the alcohol rates, and things like that. Also, she is very much cherry-picking the communities that have some of the worst social conditions in the country. You know, I could very easily go through and if I was wanting to do the same thing for the United States at large and choose cities that have certain social conditions that are more challenging than others, but to then come behind and suggest a sweeping policy that applies to all of them would be to disregard those unique circumstances of each community have their historic base, and that's essentially what she's doing. Each have a historic base that has made these conditions present in their community.
One thing you recommend in your piece in The Atlantic that would maybe be aimed at the unique nature of all the different communities, you're looking for more sovereignty from recognized by the federal government, more autonomy from the federal government, I gather, so that communities could make their own decisions more tailored to their own situations. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Each of these communities, as I mentioned, has their own history. So any time the federal government has tried to dictate from Washington a single unified Indian policy that applies to everyone, it has been a complete disaster and has been incredibly destructive to Native communities culturally, economically, socially. All of these elements have played out for the near destruction of many tribes. The only way we are going to see social and economic advancement in Native communities is to pull back and allow those tribes to decide what is needed in their community, whether it is more health care services, whether it is housing for elders, schools, whatever it may be. The federal government has the obligation to carry out the treaties and the various compacts that they've signed with these tribes, but it doesn't mean that they should have to dictate where every single dollar goes if it doesn't make sense for that community. It must, all of the changes that are going to bring about beneficial social and economic advancement for Native American tribes are going to be rooted within the tribes themselves. Let them decide what they need for their own communities.
We're talking to Kelly Mosteller. She's director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center and a tribal historic preservation officer. She says a sweeping change, one of her previous guests had called for, to private land ownership across the board is not the best solution for economic problems facing Native American communities.
And we want to hear from you on this. Tell us where you stand on private land ownership for Native American reservations. Do you think it would help or that the benefits are overstated? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're a member of a tribe, tell us how you view land and what it means to you and your community. And tell us what you think the federal government's role on reservations should be. Again, that number, 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up the conversation with Kelly Mosteller. She says private land ownership is not the solution to poverty in Native American communities. We heard the argument for private land ownership on reservations in particular last month from Naomi Schaefer Riley, author of the book The New Trail of Tears.
And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're a member of a tribe, we want to hear how you feel. In particular, tell us what you think the federal government's role should be on reservations, especially as controversy around the Dakota Access Pipeline continues. Our number is 800-642-1234.
And Kelly, I want to go back to that previous interview we mentioned, the guest making the case that modern issues of stereotyping, not a big part of the problem. I'm going to give a little listen here to her talking about the Native American mascot issue.
I went to a variety of Indian communities across the country, and I was hard-pressed to find somebody who thought about changing team names or mascots as a priority in addressing the needs of their community. And as you can see from a recent Washington Post poll that suggested that 9 out of 10, or more than 9 out of 10, American Indians said they didn't really care about the name Redskins for the Washington football team.
So Kelly, how do you think these issues about mascots and symbols fit into the larger conversation?
I think that symbols have power and words have power. The first issue that I have with her statement is the citing of the Washington Post poll. That is an incredibly problematic poll. It allowed for people who self-identify as Native American to comment as though they were tribal members, and that would include anyone who, you know, their family history tells that there was a Native American person somewhere in the past. You know, they could claim to be Native American. If you poll people who are enrolled members of federally recognized tribes, those numbers are much stronger to show that this is an issue. And there has been a lot of work done around this in recent years, and there are studies that have been conducted that shows that it does impact young Native Americans, especially those in elementary school. It affects their self-esteem and the way they see themselves and the way their classmates see them. One of the phrases that I heard Naomi Schaefer Riley use was that it is absurd and offensive to focus energies on issues like the mascot issue when there are so many other social problems. And to use the words absurd and offensive, for the efforts of a Native community that they themselves have decided this is important for their community is exactly what I was discussing earlier. It is about not understanding sovereignty. The Oneida Nation, for example, has chosen to make the mascot issue a priority for them, and they have actually launched the website changethemascot.org. Each of these communities has the right to set what is a priority for them, and so to be disparaging of that by saying it's absurd and offensive is inappropriate. It's highly inappropriate. And I can say that as a Native American who works in a Native community with Native youth, it does affect them. A high school very close to us has the mascot of the Savages, and many of the students I've worked with attend that school, and they talk to me about how it made them feel to have that name and that mascot around them every day, and to go to pep rallies and see effigies of Native Americans being drugged behind cars and things like that. It happens every year around football season, and I had a young student who actually, in her graduation announcement, she, at the very top of it, said, on her graduation announcement, "I'm not a savage, I'm a Muskogee." It takes away the individual identity, and as I said earlier, words have power. It really does matter, and I've heard it firsthand from students who say that it does.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Aaron, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just like to make a comment about that last comment. Wow, yes, mascots should be abolished. I went to high school, Mound Mohawks, and now it's the West Tonka Wildcats, and I'm very glad that they did change that. But my reason for calling was a comment about if they make all tribal lands private, then that would open up the possibility of a very wealthy land developer or oil company to come in and purchase that land, and then there'd be no more reservations.
Aaron, thanks for the call. Kelly?
I completely agree. It opens up to land speculation. When land is held privately, it opens up the possibility for the claim of eminent domain. Private land ownership does not have the same protections that trust land has. Also, the tribes do not have the authority to speak as a sovereign nation on privately held land. So, for example, with the Dakota Access Pipeline, I've heard some arguments made that, well, if the tribe had owned that land privately, they could have stopped the pipeline. And I think that's a naive description of the situation. There are a lot of ways that private lands are taken from private citizens every day, but it is much more difficult if the tribe has trust status on that land. They are seen as the sovereign governing body over that land, and their tribal historic preservation officer, of which I am for my tribe, has a lot more authority on the projects that take place on that land.
Aaron, thanks for that call. We're talking to Kelly Mosteller, director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center, talking about land ownership, Native Americans, and federal law and federal treaties. We'll go next to Lucille in Luxembourg from Oklahoma, I understand. Lucille, hi.
Hi. I don't think they should let the land go to private owners. It's my opinion. I think that the Indians should have their own land, and they should take care of it, and the private people should stay away from it. But I also want to know is my husband's mother put on her birth certificate she was white. How does he go about finding out his heritage?
So wait, do you think she was actually Native American, Lucille?
Yes, he's Cherokee. He's part Cherokee.
All right, Lucille.
His grandmother was a medicine woman in the tribe.
Lucille, thanks for that call. I don't know if you want to address that briefly, Kelly, if there's a way to track tribal heritage.
Actually, if she does have a inclination as to what tribe he would have been a member of, you can reach out to that tribe's tribal enrollment department, and each tribe has their own qualifications for how to get on their rolls. So that is dictated by each sovereign tribe.
All right. Lucille, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Matthew in Baraboo. Matthew, hi.
Hi. I'm actually taking cultural diversity class right now. We are actually covering this very subject right now. And we're in the subject right now where they had actually abolished the private land ownership from the Native Americans. And I was just wondering, why would we be bringing up the subject of trying to make it private once again? We originally disregarded all our responsibilities federally and allowed the tribes to take over their own lands on the reservation land.
Matthew, bad signal there, but I think we get the gist. And Kelly, you've written and said that you're kind of surprised that we're bringing back kind of a 19th century idea that you say has already failed.
Absolutely. This is essentially the same principle as allotment, which was a policy that was implemented in the late 19th century. Different tribes had to undergo the allotment process at different times, but it essentially took commonly held land and surveyed it out and broke it into different parcels, and each tribal member was to select a parcel and eventually get the title to that land and to become private landowners, with the end result in claiming to be that they would become assimilated farmers and prosper. What happened almost every single case is that the land was taxed, or that there would be a crop failure and someone wouldn't be able to pay taxes, or that, as the first caller mentioned, land speculators would come through and undercut an individual or outright steal land that wasn't being occupied at that time and just be a squatter, and all of a sudden there's all kinds of legal questions about who owns the land. So we have seen this policy implemented before under another name.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Kelly Mosteller, director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center. She's a tribal historic preservation officer. We've been talking about Native Americans, land ownership, and federal law. Last month we talked to a guest who said we need more private land ownership. Kelly made the case against it today.